I'm Scott Hansen with NFL Red Zone, and you are listening to the Gridiron Gentlemen.
Hello and welcome to the Gridiron Gentlemen podcast. We'll be carrying on our delve into the draft and our draft prospects with what's usually an exciting position group, but is more dread and horror this year. And another position group that is, for want of a lack of a better term, terrible. And you can decide which one's which. So we'll be doing quarterbacks and tight ends. And joining me as always, James, how are you?
I'm good. I'm surprisingly good. The one thing I would say is we're going to end on a high, so we're going to do quarterbacks first. But the surprising thing I found about the tight end class was while there is a big drop, there's still guys on day three in the tight end class that you can kind of squint and maybe see it. The quarterbacks, not so much.
No, I don't think there's got to be. There's maybe two guys that I'd take a dart throw at quarterback.
Yeah.
Even in the rest, I'm like, no.
Yeah.
The last few we've counted from kind of bottom of our guys to top. I'm not starting with any of these quarterbacks. I don't know. We've not spoken about quarterback yet between us.
Yeah.
So I don't know how far down we want to go. I don't know how many you want to talk about and things like that. So I say we just start at the top, see how long we go. Because we're getting close to the draft, we do need to get through both positions. So if it gets a bit long, I think we just need to cut it short on quarterbacks and then go on to tight ends. Because we've got two we need to do next week, and then we need to have another one. Wide receiver is going to be its own, because unlike these position groups, it's deep and good. So I think we start with the good guys, quote unquote good guys, I should say. See how far we get and then go from there, if you agree.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think there's much suspense in QB1, I don't think, unless you're really throwing a spanner in the works.
Yeah. No, I've got no suspense whatsoever.
No, right. Fernando Mendoza. He's everyone's number one. He should go number one. He will go number one, and the Oakland Raiders will not trade away the pick. He is going to be an Oakland Raider. The draft starts at number two, put it that way.
Yeah, pretty much.
No.
So... yeah.
Do you want to go first?
No, you go.
Mine's kind of brief because his comp's Chad Pennington to me. Very good at everything, not great really at anything. He's mobile enough to do the job, but he's not going to light your fire. He's got a big enough arm, but he's not big. He's accurate enough, but he's not Joe Burrow accurate. He's kind of Joe Burrow light almost. But the reason that, for me anyway, I've recently, is we've did this more and more, and me and you've always kind of did the quarterbacks, even when everyone was doing different position groups and it wasn't just ourselves.
Yeah.
I've adjusted my scouting on the quarterbacks as I kind of start tracking how my picks and my views are. And I basically now have two main criteria for quarterback. Generally, they all have guys that you're talking about to go top five or top 10, generally all have physical tools that are good enough. What I've found seems to be what translates is they got better every year. They start from multiple years. Those two things are the most important things for me now. Yeah. I want their last year to be better than their second last year, and their second last year to be better than their first year. Mm. And I want them to have started at least 30 games at college.
Yeah.
Fernando Mendoza is the only quarterback that meets both those criteria, except maybe Diego Pavia, who I just don't think is in this kind of conversation for a totally different reason that we might go on to later. I don't know if we're going to talk about him. But they're the only two guys that I think genuinely got better every year and have started 30 games. It's a worrying class for the non-Mendoza guys that just don't have the starts or weren't good the last year. And that's not a good sign. It means you're not coachable. Mendoza, for his credit, seems to be extremely coachable. He's also a bit of a gamer. And we kind of spoke about this because we've spoken about everyone he went up against throughout the defensive podcast we've did so far. He rose to the occasion when he was playing against a team that had five first-rounders on his defense. And he got whacked. if you hear him talk, you probably don't think he's that tough. But he takes a beating and just gets up and goes for it. I don't think he's elite at anything, but I just think he's good at everything. I think he's accurate. I think he's poised. I think he throws on time. I don't think he's got the best anticipation in this class, and we'll get on to why my QB2 is my QB2 solely because he has anticipation later. But he is just, there's no distinct weakness to his game, other than I think there's a distinct ceiling to him.
Yeah.
But he has earned, and I know there's a lot of, as the season went on, we kind of spoke about quarterbacks, and I think you more so than me at one point had a bit of trepidation in him still. But I think he rose to the occasion, and I think he's earned himself being the number one pick. And would he be number one in most draft classes? I really don't think so. Is he number one in this draft? 100%. And I think it really is that simple.
Yeah, I would agree. I think in a few historic classes in the last 10 years, he probably would still have gone number one overall. I think the Kenny Pickett year, he would have hands down been way ahead of Pickett. I think if we compare him to...
See, on this note, just quickly, who was number one pick the year Geno was drafted? Do you remember, you know? Because he would have went number one that year, 100%. But I want to know if you remember who was the number one pick.
Yeah, he
Geno
would
was
have.
The second.
He would have.
Geno was
the
the
first
second
one was...
pick that year.
It was EJ Manuel, wasn't it?
EJ Manuel at about 17 or something like that.
Yeah, so I would have put Mendoza a long way ahead of him. I think if we go and back to the Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, Bo Nix, Michael Penix, I would have had him at QB4. I would have had him just behind May, and I would have had him a tier above Nix and Penix. Just and in that draft, I would have said maybe somewhere between picks 10 and 15 were the good spot. So the reason he probably in most quarterback classes wouldn't be a top 10 pick is just because it's like you say, there's no clear trait that he's been born with that is exceptional. Like you say, the arm is good enough, the anticipation is good enough, the accuracy is good enough, pocket movement is good enough. The nuts and bolts of his accuracy and his sense of timing, they're good enough. And that is the definition of someone who is like a middle of the first round kind of guy in a normal class. But this is not a normal quarterback class. And he is someone who, what he does have is something that quite a few other collegiate quarterbacks don't have, or quite a lot of quarterbacks, and almost all the quarterbacks in this class specifically don't have.
I said talent is what they don't have.
Well, they don't have, well, the talent is part of it, but the other thing that he has is, and you've kind of alluded to it, is toughness. So if I look at, there are certain games where if you watch the game, if you look at the defensive box score for his opponents, so for example, versus Wisconsin, right? He was sacked 5 times. He was pressured 18 times. He went 22 of 24 with 299 yards and 4 scores with no picks.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And he was pressured 18 times and sacked 5 times. Okay? Mm-hmm. In the playoffs, right? He was sacked in the 4 playoff games that he played. He was sacked. Let me just count this up because it's pretty brutal. It's 10 sacks across 4 games, 2.5 sacks a game, that he was pressured 37 times in those 4 games. So that's 9 pressures and 2.5 sacks a game. And you know, he had 3 games where he was sacked 3 times. All of those games he won. And across those 4 games, he threw 1 interception. He is ice cold under pressure. Ice cold. Just, I mean, it's like we mentioned the Ohio State game. First play of the game. Absolutely flattened. Gets up.
Should have been targeting.
Yep. It should also have been a hospital visit.
Yes,
he just
so.
Gets, he just gets straight back up and cool and calm as you like, dices up a defense that's got five first round picks on it. So, see, you know, we just kind of what we saw was a masterclass in like resiliency and poise, which I think is the box you really want ticked if someone with this kind of physical traits is going to be someone that you really consider this high. And he answered the bell in the most high pressure situations very emphatically. So in the games where he was under the most duress, he often played really, really well at his best. You know, so I really like that. I like just I like who he is. I like the person. I like the player, because it, when you juxtapose that kind of personality off the field with the personality on the field, it's fine. He's nerdy off the field, but he's tough as you like on the field. Not quite the same way as Andrew Luck, but it's a similar kind of vibe with Andrew Luck. Andrew Luck was a guy who'd read books about concrete to his teammates on the bus, you know, or he'd nerd out about architecture on the bus for the game. But when he set foot on the field, he was the biggest animal on the field. And so it's kind
Another
of,
one. People don't think it because he's into fashion and things like that. Joe Burrow. He sits and watches SpongeBob on a Saturday night and things like that. Like he wears like Iron Man socks and things and then goes on the field and he hits people like he's a linebacker. The problem he's got is his bones aren't as tough as his mind is. And I worry that might be the same with Mendoza. But surprisingly, he's bigger than he looks.
Yeah, I was really surprised at his measurements. He's
Yeah,
6'5" and he's 230 pounds.
it
He's
doesn't
like
look it.
a, yeah, he's like a tight end on SlimFast. It's mental.
It's
It's
weird.
like, it's weird. Yeah, it is bizarre. It's bizarre. And it's like, so I think the kind that what you've got is you, yeah. Chad Pennington isn't a bad comp in terms of like play style. And another way you could potentially describe him is like the Lamborghini version of Kirk Cousins. Yeah,
By the way,
turned up
Kirk
to
Cousins had a
11.
great career. People mock him, but
Kirk Cousins has started for a decade. Okay.
yeah, that's what I mean. He's made $300 million.
And if you went back in time, you know, and were to redraft Kirk Cousins, you'd take him in the first round if you knew what his career was going to be like.
If he went in the first round, he'd still be starting for the Commanders.
Well, yeah.
They wouldn't have franchised him 3 times if he had a first round grade on him the way he performed those last 2 years of his rookie contract.
But yeah, just very briefly on the subject. Look, if you're a fourth round pick like that, and you're going into your 10th season where your whole salary is guaranteed, well
Yeah.
done you.
Yes.
You know, well done you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think somewhere between Chad Pennington and a souped up Kirk Cousins is absolutely fine. And those kinds of quarterbacks are the guys you draft in the first round. It's like a first round quarterback doesn't have to be Pat Mahomes; they just have to be a
No.
starter.
What the other thing is, and Chad obviously got derailed with injuries. That might not happen anymore. You're not allowed to touch quarterbacks anymore. Like you need to be, you will get hit occasionally, but you don't get hit the way they did in the early 2000s. Like if Chad never done his shoulder in, who knows? He's the only guy that beat Tom Brady for the division in the AFC East, and they did it twice with two different teams. Just quickly, I did a quick check. I went back to 2015, right? And I'm just going to list off all the first round quarterbacks. As you remember them, but at draft time, there'll be some that you might forget how you graded them, but who you would have them above or below. 2015, Jameis. Below Jameis.
Yeah,
For
below.
me. I think people, because of the turnovers, forget how highly rated he was coming out. I'd have him below Marcus Mariota as well. Goff, Wentz, and Paxton Lynch. Paxton Lynch, Jesus, that's a throwback.
I would have him as a prospect below Goff as a prospect.
Yeah.
I would have him just above Wentz as a prospect. and well above Paxton Lynch as a prospect. Paxton Lynch was a third round of tops.
2017 is a weird one because they went Trubisky, Mahomes, Watson. I had it completely reversed. I had it Watson, Mahomes, Trubisky. I would have had them ahead of Trubisky, but below both Mahomes and Deshaun.
I was very much someone who was not on the Mahomes bus. So I wasn't on that bus. I probably, if I'm being brutally honest, would have graded him above all three.
Yeah, fair.
Right, I could just see it translating more directly. Yeah.
The next one's another bonkers one. It was the Baker, Darnold, Allen, Rosen, and Jackson. As a prospect, I was not sold on Allen at all. I'd had him miles above Allen, probably slightly above Baker and Lamar, similar to below Darnold and below Josh Rosen, who I loved, and that's aged terribly.
Heart of hearts, I would have had him below Baker, below Darnold, below Rosen, below, who was the other quarterbacks?
It's Lamar and Allen, the two better ones.
Yeah, I would have had him below the first four and above Josh Allen, because also I wasn't a believer in Josh Allen at that point either. I couldn't see it.
Haskins, Jones and Murray. I'd probably have him above. No, I'm not having him above Kyler. But above both Jones and Dwayne Haskins.
Yeah, I would have had him above. Yeah, just behind Kyler. He would have been QB2 for me in that class.
Burrow, Tua, Herbert and Love. Both above Love, below the other three.
Yeah, I would have had him fourth, just above Love.
Then Trevor, Zach Wilson, Trey Lance, Justin Fields and Mac Jones.
I would have had him behind Lawrence and Fields.
Okay, I had Wilson higher than most, but clearly that failed. Mm. But I would have had him behind Lawrence, Wilson and Fields, but above Trey Lance and above Mac Jones.
Mm.
2022 is Pickett, we've already spoke above. Bryce Young, CJ Stroud, and Anthony Richardson. Number three, being below Young and Stroud, above Richardson.
Yeah, I would have had him third.
Spoke about 2024 already. Cam Ward, Jackson Dart, and then below Ward, but above Dart.
Totally.
Right. So he's kind of not many years that he's been QB1, but he's consistently above at least one quarterback who was taken in the first. And yeah, when you're worth a first round pick as a quarterback and you're the only one that is, you're going to go number one overall. That's just the way the NFL exactly is now.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, I think he's going, it's a promising he's a promising prospect. I think we do have to need to temper our enthusiasm a little bit because he is still going to a team that is, while it's ever so slightly better, it's still not great.
They need to fix the old line as well. Massively.
They do. They really, really do.
Right. This is where it gets interesting. Everyone in the dog has Ty Simpson as the second quarterback.
I don't.
No, dear.
No, I've changed my mind. I changed my mind completely.
My QB2, and that's going against everything that I said earlier. But like I said earlier, nobody else except Diego Pavia meets the minimum starts and getting better every year. Ty Simpson had his best year as his last year, but it's the only year he started, so meh. It's Garrett Nussmeier for me.
Same.
Good, because I don't know if I'd been an LSU homer. But it comes down to what I kind of hinted at earlier. He's the only quarterback in this class that throws with proper anticipation.
Yep.
Now, it gets him in trouble sometimes, but it's you can tell watching him, he's the son of a coach.
Mm-hmm.
He's a son of an offensive coordinator in the NFL, for that matter. Now, the big knock on him is his last year there was really, really poor.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of unknowns over how injured he was. And Brian Kelly got a lot of heat for this, but they basically played him in In my opinion, and again, they've not actually announced, and correct me if I'm wrong if you've seen anything, but I follow a lot of LSU guys, obviously, and I've not seen any confirmation of exactly how bad it was, just that he played injured all year. But just from the eye test and watching it, he couldn't twist right, because last year he was throwing 60-yard bombs, and they weren't always the most accurate, but he was consistently getting the deep ball quite well. This year, the amount of times I watched him in the deep ball and underthrow guys by about 20 yards. There was just no velocity or power behind his throw. It was incredible. Now, the problem is it's twofold. One, how much of that was injury? How much was regression? And two, even if it was all injury, how confident can you be that he'll come back better when you've not seen him throw since properly? Because I don't care. Pro days don't count. But I don't care. I seen Zach Wilson make that throw at Pro Day. I just don't care anymore. Like, do what you want at Pro Day. But from a physical tool standpoint, and even a mental tool, because although he throws the picks, he is very good at not caring, which is a trait you need, because you're going to throw picks as a rookie if you start.
Yeah.
It's a trait you need. For the record, I'm not taking him in the first round. I have one quarterback going in the first round. He's not a first rounder. But his physical tools are so much better than anyone else in the class, and I actually include Fernando Mendoza in that. Problem is, he's had injuries throughout his college career, and he's not a big quarterback. And if you get injured in college, you tend to get injured in the NFL. It doesn't tend to stop happening when you start getting hit by bigger, stronger, faster guys. But if I'm going to take a punt on somebody, I'm taking the punt on the guy with the higher upside. And I think, if you told me, ignore Mendoza, there's a quarterback that starts for 10 years in the league and has a Kirk Cousins career or a Baker Mayfield career at that kind of level, it's Ty Simpson. If you tell me there's a non-Fernando Mendoza that wins an MVP, it's Garrett Nussmeier.
Yeah, and that's kind of the reason. Well, there are certain things about him that just made it easier for me to see it happen at the next level. So what Garrett Nussmeier does well is he's got, like you say, he's got a short memory, and he is not fearless, but he is aggressive. And the thing is, he's aggressive in a way that it's not that his physical tools let him down. It's that sometimes he just has brain farts, which is something that is coachable. But like, I like the fact that he's willing to push the ball. I like that he's willing to try and fit it into spots. I like the fact that he will test the middle of the field. I like the fact that he will throw with touch and anticipation. I like the fact that he will hang in there and take hits. Not so much the fact that he's 6'1 and 205 and willing to take hits, but it's more about the whole kind of intestinal fortitude and kind of willingness to do it. Now, it turns out that he played the whole season with an abdominal injury. So a lot of your passing mechanics are controlled by your core, a lot of twisting involved. And if you have got a significant abdominal injury, it really affects your ability to throw with any sort of power, because that rotation involves a degree of rotation in the abdomen, the abdominal and chest muscles, as you turn and throw, because you throw with your whole body, and there's the rotation part of it. So that would explain it. I do sort of also think that, you know, it got to him more than it probably should have. He was a tick, you know, he was just a tick off on throws. The ball placement wasn't there, and he was sped up in the pocket a bit. But if I look at the 2024 film, another season of that, and he's easily a top 30 player. So, and it's not like his mentality changed with the injury. He didn't suddenly become a shrinking violet. It's just, he was the same guy, just limited. So I like that too. And for me, I think if I've got a guy who's played that many games under his belt, and I feel like I know what he is as stylistically, even if like the results have been a little uneven, if I like stylistically who he is, and I think that's going to work at the next level, I like the idea that he could be, you know, QB 15 to 25, which is fine. That's probably his ceiling. He might have the odd season where he really does just go off on one, and that aggression translates into real results. You know, that his floor is that he probably will be holding the clipboard most of his career, starting the odd season and playing relatively well when he does. He's the son of a quarterback as well. Doug Nussmeier was in a backup in the NFL for years, you know, and so I just feel like I don't have to squint as much as I do with my QB3.
Doing quote a comp for him, right? This is less of what he was coming out and more the sort of career I could see him having. Ryan Fitzpatrick.
What, in terms of his journey, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, like just every so often, usually in the backup, every so often he'll have a year that makes you think, Jesus, there's something there.
Yeah.
He'll pay him big money and then he just never lives up to it again for 3-4 years. Then has a blow up year and everything's always arrived and like that sort of thing.
That's probably the median sort of outcome for him. But yeah, there is a reality where actually he could actually be a starter. You know, if I were really to sort of grade him, I would put him in that sort of Tyler Shugg kind of bucket.
So, Broncos have a quarterback. If the Broncos don't have a quarterback, where would you be comfortable taking him?
If you really need him, if you really need a quarterback, okay, and Mendoza's gone, and you don't feel good about the first round, you don't feel good about, like, trading up for Mendoza or making a run at Mendoza, and you don't anything because it's a quarterback and because you have need, I think anything after 35 is probably fine. I think second round quarterback, you know, and if it works, it works. It's that kind of, you know, teams draft guys like Aiden O'Connell and they draft Tyler Shugg where they draft them because it's not quite the same investment. Those picks sort of 25 to kind of 45, it's like they're normally the same tier of player. So yeah, I you know, if let's imagine the Jets at 44. They're picking at 44, aren't they? That's their second round 2 pick. 33.
Yeah? We've got 33 and 44.
I wouldn't, my mouth wouldn't fill with vomit if it was 33 or 44. I would understand the overpay. I'd understand it.
I think anything before 50 is a bit rich for my blood.
But in a normal class, I would say so. Yeah.
But teams reach for quarterbacks all the time, so I can see it.
Yeah, and it doesn't exclude you from being able to draft one next year.
No, it doesn't. We'll get 3 first-rounders next year as well.
Exactly.
Here's a question, right? Jets take him at 44, say.
Mm-hmm.
He performs like Tyler Shough this year, but we've got the Cowboys first and the Colts first. Quarterback injury, they end up picking in the top 5. What'd you do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's the question, right? Hypothetical. Let's imagine you have a quarterback that has played the way Tyler Shugg has.
Yep.
But you have the opportunity to draft a prospect like Drake May. Does that stop you? Didn't stop me.
It wouldn't. The problem is, I don't have Drake May that high.
Yeah, but if you had a prospect that you could see could be like that.
Yeah, no, I get that.
If there was a prospect where you're just like, I don't have to do anywhere near the squinting.
Do you know who's going to be going top 5 next year? It's not a quarterback.
Oh, I certainly do.
Would you rather Tyler Shough and Jeremiah Smith. Or
Oh, God.
a rookie quarterback that's going to go top five. But that's a conversation for another day. I won't force you to pick.
I need 12 months to think about that.
Somebody's going to be in that position whereby they've got a quarterback that they think, eh, maybe, maybe, maybe. But Smith's sitting there. It's going to be somebody that's in that position.
Yeah.
Now, third, I'm going to the guy that everyone else has two now, Ty Simpson.
Same.
Okay, right. Ty Simpson is... his big weakness, basically, is he's had maybe seven or eight game stretch that was good football. He's only started, was it 14 games, I think? 12? The NSC Championship? Yeah, 13, 14, 15 games it would be. So 12 regular season,
yeah.
SEC Championship and two playoff.
Yep.
Yeah. So he started 15 games. He looked like he was going to win the Heisman about week 7 or 8. And then he dropped off a bit of a cliff. He kind of got it back on for the last few weeks. It was never quite the same, but it certainly wasn't as bad as it was during that mid-period. The problem is there's a couple of potential reasons. One, the defensive coach was just figuring out what he was doing.
Yeah.
Two, was it just a bad fit of form by a guy who's never had to go through that because he's not played a lot of games? Three, and I think there's a bit of all of them, but three is, for some reason, Alabama couldn't run the ball at all. And when you can't run the ball at all, playing in the SEC, it's very hard to throw the ball. They go hand in hand. But if you're going to be drafting a quarterback and you expect him to be good, if you want him to be good, you expect him to start, etc., etc., you're going to end up paying him, hopefully. And if you pay him, there is weaknesses in the rest of the whole, the team that he needs to overcome. And he's not a guy that I think will ever be able to overcome that. He is kind of what we said about Fernando Mendoza, but a step below everything. He's good at everything without being even very good at anything. But the biggest thing is the lack of starts terrifies me. There is no NFL quarterback currently, I think, in the top 10 that has started less than 30 games at college. The only ones I can think that even come close to being that in the last like 30 years is Kyler. The other one's Cam Newton, but he did actually start like 25, 30 games. It's just half of them were at junior college because he dropped out and whatnot. The other one that didn't start 30 is Joe Burrow, but I think he ended up starting like 28 because he had 13 games his first year, 15 games his second year, and he was also in college for like 5 years because he then had 3 years as a backup at Ohio State as well. Sometimes that benefit helps as well, just being around that many. I just have no reason to suspect he's ever going to be able to be a long-term starter in the NFL. There is no comp for him working out.
I mean, the only comp that you can really have, I think, is probably in terms of playing time, and it's the only comp that the only way that they're similar is probably Mitch Trubisky coming out of UNC. He had 13 starts. So, but
sorry, I mean comp that worked.
Sorry?
I mean comp that was worth the pick going high. Like,
it was worth it, God, yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's none. Because the other one, there's been a few because you had Trey Lance. There's been a few that's only started a year, but there's none that you would look at and go, he was worth getting picked in the first round.
It's a fair point. I mean, it's the thing about him, those first 7 or 8 games were very impressive. They were really, really impressive. But then the injury itself, he retreated into a shell in a way. And it was a disturbing experience to kind of watch, because there was a lot of confidence and a lot of kind of a lot of, he was confident, he was poised, he was playing on time, he was, you know, on time in the pocket, on schedule, playing quick but not fast, and he was playing loose but not erratic. And then there's a very definite change. So the LSU game is the first game where you see him, the mechanics just get really sped up. The whole experience of watching him play feels so much more frenetic and more kind of frantic. And he's playing fast, and he is thinking fast and reacting slow. So, and then he starts to overcompensate by, the second he would get off his first read, he would rush his second and gets the check down too early. Whereas in the first eight games, he was going one, two, three, and often he was hitting three before he would get to the check down. But because he was being sped up mentally, he wasn't allowing himself the time to go one, two, three, check down. He was going one, two, oops, check down. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of short-circuiting the rhythm. And I think he played like somebody who was afraid of having the injury aggravated, because he was potentially more injured than he was letting on. It turns out it was multiple injuries he had, which is kind of understandable. But when I think about 6'2", 208, it's quite a slight frame. And I think, you know, guys are tough, but like the reality is with that kind of frame, you're not going to be as physically resilient unless you are an outlier in that sense. Like, actually, for example, we knock Trey Lance for being like quite a slight build and quite a skinny guy. He doesn't miss that much time through injury because of his size, but you get the sense that Ty Simpson, who is objectively taller and a bit bigger than Bryce Young, is potentially more fragile when he is carrying injury. And that worries me. The other thing that worries me is the fact that he retreated into his shell and he stopped being aggressive and he became somebody who was very sort of contained and very sort of, and looked like an inexperienced quarterback. The other shocking statistical fact is that he threw on, in week one, he threw his first touchdown pass in 1,563 days. He had not thrown a touchdown pass since his senior year of high school.
Yeah.
So nearly 5 years since he'd thrown a touchdown pass in a competitive game. And so it's that concerns you a bit.
Was he in school for 4 years?
Yeah. So he was at Alabama at 22. Saban recruited him.
Jesus Christ, I didn't realise. I thought he still had a couple years left if he'd went back.
Yeah. Now he was behind, God, who was he behind? He was behind, who was before Milroe? He was behind Bryce Young. He was behind Bryce Young for 1 year and Jalen Milroe for two.
Yeah. Jesus.
So he's been there a long, long time, and I think he was originally a 4-star, which I can't help but wonder if he had kind of maybe transferred out and got a bit more experience, maybe we'd have had a clearer picture. But I understand why people really love him.
Was it Miami offered him $7 million?
Yeah, and he decided to stay.
No, this year.
Yeah, and he decided to stay at Bama.
No. Like, instead of going to the draft, they offered him this year.
Yeah, but if you think about it, right, by the time if he had done that, he would be he'd be 24 years old.
I don't know, but I don't think he'll earn any more than that in the NFL.
Mm.
Unless he goes in the first, these contracts, I think the second round contract's something like 5 million throughout the 4 years, or like 7 million if you stay the full 4 years.
Well, he was offered money to leave Bama, but didn't take it.
There's been people asking why he's not staying at Bama, because he won't start next year. They've got the young boy that's incredible. Can't remember his name now off the top of my head. But
yeah.
I don't see enough upside to justify a high round pick.
Yeah, I mean, people that really like him are like, so people like Dan Orlovsky, and I understand why Orlovsky likes him, because he runs an offense that is similar to a pro style offense, and you know, you see him do things like setting and changing protections, you see him, you know, making adjustments at the line and all of that, and that's all well and good. But actually, he doesn't do it very well because he doesn't set protection well enough. I don't get it, because I think it's all well and good saying, well, he sets his own protections, but Ty Simpson doesn't set his own protections very well, because he isn't able to actually protect himself from being blitzed in a way that means that he can find his heart. He was not amazing under pressure after injury. He actually fell off a cliff versus pressure after injury. And when he went up against teams that were really, really good, they really got in his head. Really, really did. And that concerns me, because if you can't play well under pressure in college, if your game is like a tale of two quarterbacks clean and under pressure, that only really magnifies at the NFL.
Yeah.
Because so I think it's, for me, he just feels and like there's not the same level of aggression, the same level of, he's not a highly skilled thrower. Like, I consider Nussmeier to be a more skilled thrower, more accurate and more aggressive. Simpson's got fewer turnovers, but I just see this player who, for me, is the kind of quarterback who, under siege at the next level, would come apart quite easily and unravel a bit. And that would be my concern, that would potentially stunt his growth. Also, he is 23, and he'd be 23 and four years in the same school, 23 years old, and to have only had 600 dropbacks it's not the body of work you want to see, especially when, you know, the second half of the season was fourth round tape.
Yeah. I'm not taking him high. However, they're the only three I've got a top 100 rounder on, a top 100 pick in.
Yeah.
Nobody else might even take the top 100.
No, I couldn't get there with anyone. So, like, QB4, it's just whoever's there, because there are teams who could. Okay, my least favorite watch in this whole class, and I'll talk about them now.
Is this your QB4 just now?
Well,
you can go any route you want, because from 40 to 40 is just blah.
Exactly, and this is it. And so it's just basically, I'm now just talking about players who are getting buzz, or you know, or we have thought of differently in the past. So, for example, Drew Allar at Penn State. Watching Drew Allar was absolutely just frustrating. And that's not all his fault. The Penn State offense blows my mind. It shifts for no good reason. It lines up in one formation, completely shifts. It will shift back again for no reason that I can fathom, other than it looks fun. And then it's like they will go through, you know, they'll move all their skill position players left to right into different formations, et cetera, et cetera, just to run power through the A gap. And it's like, was that necessary, guys? You know, or they'll do it just to throw something short, you know, of a simple concept. And it's just, was that really worth it? Because it didn't really achieve very much. So the offense itself blew my mind and just made me sad and empty inside, because I was having to do far too much thinking about what the offense was doing and how it fit within it. And then I looked at Drew Aller, and I looked at him and I thought, he looks the part. He's 6'5", he's 230. It's just, he looks so, just if you were to draw one, he looks like an NFL quarterback. He looks like the kind of guy that you draft, you know, in the top five physically. But then the athlete is not, you know, the packaging does not fit the athlete. He's got some juice to him. He's got some ability as a runner. He can, but on the move, he's a bit clunky and robotic. And it's like, is he that much better an athlete than Mendoza? Maybe a tiny bit. But, and he's okay throwing on the move. I quite like that. He does have the ability to throw with real velocity and whip. He can access any throw he wants to, any part of the field. But when he accesses the middle of the field, it's very sort of scattershot, and you kind of you're sort of looking through your fingers and going, no, 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 because it's just like a lot of the trajectory is kind of like barely above linebackers' heads, and it's drilled in there, and there's not a lot of touch or placement, and it's like, oh God, you've got so. And then I look at him in the pocket, and it's all very sort of hurried, and then it's like his upper body and his lower body are not in sync. He's got happy feet, which is never good. You know, it's all very toes. He's on his toes the whole time. He can't seem to sort of settle down and get both cleats in the ground and have a firm base to throw from. And he gets away with it because he has just like this ridiculous arm. And that's all well and good if you're Pat Mahomes or Josh Allen, you know, or Caleb Williams, but he is not that person. He's not. He's Drew Aller. And it's like, if you get both cleats in your ground, son, a firm base, and get your front shoulder pointing towards the target, you'll do a lot better than being toesy because you're feeling pressure that isn't necessarily there. So I found the whole watch for him very, very sort of, yeah, I see that there's tools, but is it a quarterback? And I don't know that it is a quarterback at this precise moment in time. It's not even a very good collegiate prospect. So
no,
for me, he feels like a day three player. And like a sort of...
Everyone we're talking about now is day three at best.
Yeah, and if he is a day three player, it starts with a two, not a one.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah. And that's where I am. And he probably is QB4A or 4B. I mean, it's... There's people talking about, like, Cole Payton. And it's like... I get it. But it's like... It's a North Dakota State quarterback, and they all have the same problem. It's North Dakota State. You are going to have 18 dropbacks a game. You can start for 3 years. You'll probably only throw 500 passes in three seasons. He only started for 1 year.
Probably went three national championships.
Yeah, but you'll run the ball more than you throw it. And it's like, and what they tend to have is they will have quarterbacks who are ridiculous athletes with enough quarterback skill to run that very specific offense. So it doesn't prepare them for the NFL, but you, and this is, I think Trey Lance is the best quarterback prospect they've ever had, but every prospect that they've sent to the draft since has had that same problem. They've been athletically freakish. They've had some of the basic traits that you need as a quarterback turned up to 11. You know, you'll have the arm, there'll be an athlete in there, and it will be, but at the same time, they'll be so underdeveloped as players with so few pass attempts to really kind of assess them on that you are guessing. And Cole Payton, it's like, I like the 6'3", I like the 230 pounds, I like the frame, I like the athlete. But it's 1 year of production. He only had 299 dropbacks. He only actually threw the ball 226 times. It's 16 touchdowns, 4 picks. It's like, it's a projection, and it's the kind of projection that you make on day three. And he needs a lot of work because he is not precisely accurate.
Pat Mahomes had half of his production in that one game against Oklahoma.
the Baker game.
The Baker versus Pat Mahomes game.
The 1,216 passing yards.
Yes. Yes. 740 or something Mahomes had that game.
And
I lost.
I remember watching that game and it was crazy. And I do remember thinking and watching Pat Mahomes and going, he'll never get away with that in the NFL. I mean, sure, it's fun. It's never going to work in the NFL. No one's going to let him get away with that. But they did. But yeah, Cole Payton, I can't. It's like just, yeah, it's a project. It really, really is.
Another Carson one that Beck. Was high at one
point.
Carson Beck. Carson Beck frustrates me in so many different ways. Because.
Yes.
So, come back two or three years ago, everyone thought he was going to be a number one pick. Do you know the story of why he transferred?
Refresh my memory.
So, he was obviously in Georgia. And do you know the really, really attractive twins that play college basketball, the girls?
Oh, right.
He was dating one of them. And they decided, him and the girl he was dating, decided to move to Miami together. And then within a week of landing in Miami, he cheated on her.
Oh, dude. Brutal.
It's like, it's an epitome of his on-field performance. It's so, for anyone that didn't watch the national championship game, he was the Miami quarterback. And Indiana were ahead start to finish. But with about a minute and a half to go, they were down, was it five or six they were down by Miami? Don't matter. They were down by less than a touchdown, anyway. A minute and a half to go up at midfield. Everybody I knew went, I'm just waiting for the back-breaking Carson Beck interception here. But the thing is, he's not like a mad gunslinger. He's not like Brett Favre, and you need to live with interceptions. He's like early Tom Brady, but throws picks. But it's like, you can't be doing both. You can't play conservative and turn the ball over. It doesn't work. And I don't get why anyone likes him. I don't see it. Right, the reason why people like him is because he can run an offense effectively. But at the time you want him to least attempt a deep throw is the time he's going to attempt it. He won't throw it deep the full game until he only needs 6 yards, and then he'll decide, now I'm going to throw it 40.
Yeah, basically.
And you're like, what are you doing? At this point, it's 3rd and 4, and we're trying to run out the clock. Why are you trying to go for 40 yards? What are you doing? You're not throwing it deep all game. 3rd and 20, he won't throw it deep, but in 3rd and 40, it frustrates the life out of me. But what really annoys me is, he played quite well that Indiana game until that point.
Yeah.
But everybody knew what he was going to do in that moment. I think if we go too deep in any of these quarterbacks, I'm just going to get annoyed now.
If we're going to just briefly summarize it. So, you know how I mentioned about Ty Simpson post-injury and how he fell apart versus pressure? Carson Beck versus under pressure is just shocking. I can't do it. I just can't do it. It's a different thing. It's a different player. It all comes apart, and I've never experienced a player. If I told you he was 6'4 and 220, would you believe me?
Is he?
Yeah. Much bigger than you think.
If I had to guess, I would have went 6-2, 205.
Exactly, Ty Simpson kind of frame.
Yeah.
No. It's a big player, but it's like it comes up small, and everything about him comes up small, particularly under pressure. It's weird. So I can't get there with him, and the way it unravels and the lack of sort of like elite tier physical tools. He is day three, and it starts with a one.
Yeah, I'm not sold.
No. And
Right.
then I think everybody else is kind of just dart throws, but you mentioned Diego Pavia. He's an interesting conversation.
So, for anyone that doesn't know, Diego Pavia is five. Did he measure at 5'10"? Is that what he'd ended up coming in at?
5'10" and 7/8".
5'10" is 7'8", right? So 5'11", basically. So he's going to 5'10", 207. He's one that is 5 year starter, I believe. But 2 years at kind of 3 years at small food. He's transferred twice, didn't Trying to get you back up. Yeah, so he started at the New Mexico Military Institute, played for 2 seasons, then transferred to New Mexico State University, and then transferred to Vanderbilt. And he started 2 years at Vanderbilt and is probably their most successful player in football all time. They are not a football school, they're a baseball school and an academic school. And he had them beat Alabama. He also beat Tennessee, which is their in-state rival. And I think they were 9-3. And three, and in my opinion, could have made the playoffs, but rightfully didn't. But they were one of the bubble teams. And for anyone that knows anything about Vanderbilt football, that is not what Vanderbilt football do. They're not even in the
No,
periphery usually. They're usually praying to make a bowl game. But what he is, he's like not stylistically, but almost in the way he galvanizes people. There's a bit of Baker about him.
yeah,
And
definitely.
that overlooked, undersized, but everybody in the locker room loves him and gets behind him, and he is a leader of men. But he's just not that athletically gifted of a thrower. And he's
No.
not big enough to run over people, and he's not fast enough to run around people at the next level. I think he reminds me of Stetson Bennett in totally different ways, but just kind of probably just good to have around the team. Very different in the way they do it, but like always overlooked. But teams are probably better when they're on the roster, but probably won't play much.
So, yeah, it's a very backyard style. The offense is very kind of
Johnny
RPO-heavy. It's
Manziel-esque.
very, it is, it is, it's simple plays, simple reads, a lot of sort of read option and a lot of RPO. Now, some people will say, yeah, but Doug Flutie was 5'10". Doug Flutie was indeed 5'10", but Doug Flutie was also low key, like a guy who ran 4'5" and could throw the ball 70 yards on a frozen rope. And he had exceptional arm talent, which is why Doug Flutie played in two leagues for 21 years. So they're not the same. I think Pavia is maybe not even day three. He would be a priority undrafted free agent. You would get him in as your quarterback four or five for camp and see what happens from there. But I think realistically, if you're starting is not something that you would really see for him in any real way, unless it was a situation where you literally had to open up a fresh can of quarterbacks or sign someone off the street. Because many reps is he going to get in practice with the first team? Probably 10 the whole of camp. And it's like there's so much development that would be needed. But yeah, he'd be a great guy to have in the locker room. Great guy to be a backup in terms of like, just great for team chemistry and someone who would be probably pretty good at sort of teaching and running the scout team, but you couldn't start him. Not at this stage anyway.
And he's not young either because he started that many years.
Yeah, in fact, he is 20, yeah, he's 24. So
Yeah.
yeah, he'd be 25 in February. And it's a bad combination to have. But it's a shame because like he's a good college quarterback.
Yeah.
Winning college quarterbacks. It's like,
The
you like the guy.
these guys, the reason why I'm happy NIL is now a thing. Like, I never really minded Peyton Manning not getting paid at college because whatever.
Yeah.
They're in $200 million, $300 million, etc. in the NFL. The guys like Diego Pavia, who maybe get a seven rounder, maybe make a couple hundred grand over the next couple of years, and then never get to play football again and end up selling insurance. It's good that they can make a couple million in college, playing in front of the 70,000, 80,000, 90,000 that they are every week. Right, that's me done with quarterback. I don't know if there's anyone else you want to talk about, but it's just a bore now.
Just yeah, lots of players with loopy throwing motions who fall apart under pressure. Looking at UK Klubnik as well. Just thought I'd throw the name in there and just say, look, that's why I've not spoken about him in any detail. He blows my mind, and the Clemson offense is impossible. It makes it almost impossible to assess anybody properly, including Trevor Lawrence. Looking back on it, so yeah, I think with quarterbacks, that's kind of where we are.
Right, tight end. Very similar, actually, in many ways. There's one guy consistently mocked in the first round. He is my number one tight end. Is there any shocks? Is he yours?
He's definitely mine as well.
Yeah. Right. Now, for anyone not listening, Kenyon Sadiq, Oregon. For the record, I do not have a first round grade on him. He will go in the first. It looks like he's going to go mid first, really.
Yeah.
I just wasn't that impressed. When I watched Oregon, it was never him my eyes were drawn to. Don't think his route running is actually better than I thought it was going to be when I started watching tape, because
Yep.
live, I just really didn't think it was great. But I just don't think there's great separation. But that I don't necessarily mean against the cornerback or the safety guard on him. I mean in terms of separating him from the pack of tight ends. It just seems like a slightly better version of everybody else. I don't see that. Like we've talked about with what Fernando Mendoza doesn't have. I don't see what his special skill set is at the next level. And I think all the great tight ends have that. Kelce's is the fact that no matter what, he will get open. You watch a game and Kelce's just sitting in 10 yards of space, and you're like, how has he got 10 yards of space 15 yards down the field on third and 10 every time? Everyone knows the ball's going to him, and he's always wide open. Gronk's was basically everything, but Gronk's was basically no matter where you threw the ball, it was bigger than if you were fast enough to keep up with Gronk. You weren't big enough to tackle him. And if you're big enough, you couldn't actually athletically compete with him in terms of where he can get his arms to and things like that. You can go down the list. Antonio Gates was an ex-basketball player, so it was elite athleticism and great hands. And you just go down the list. The great tight ends all have something about them. Jason Witten was just the ultimate. His hands, just he didn't drop things. Like,
Exactly.
and I don't know what Kenyon Sadiq is. And I think we get this way quite a lot now. And the one that really made me change my mind on tight ends, and I'm blanking on his name, got taken before Ja'Marr Chase, tight end out of Florida.
Carpets.
Kyle Pitts. Kyle Pitts is a wide receiver, technically. And I think I started to think production
in performance translated better than it does. And I just don't think it does with tight ends. I think with tight ends, because offenses are so often built to them, it's a position where I've really started looking at traits, and I'm like, right, if I flop him in this team, what separates him from the tight end group they've already got? And I don't know what would separate Kenyon Sadiq from most of the tight end groups you're going to drop him into, other than he might be a slightly better version. And I just don't think that's worth a first round pick at that position. I don't know if any of that really made sense or not.
It does. And I think the thing, the Kyle Pitts lesson, and it's an important lesson, and we might have to learn it with Sadiq as well. So the important lesson we've got is that, and it's almost like counterintuitive and talking out of both sides of your mouth to say it. But with tight ends, we have seen that more often than not, the athletic upside tends to be more correlatory with successful tight end play. But at the same time, just because someone has high-end physical traits, it doesn't automatically mean that they have the skill set to be that elite tier tight end. So for every Mark Andrews, there's a David Njoku. Yeah?
Yeah.
For every George Kittle, round three, there is Evan Ingram. Right? All fabulous athletes. But for some reason, those guys translated into being better tight end players. Now,
do what I think it is.
I think you're going to say what I'm going to say.
I'll let you go and I'll see if I am or not.
Okay. So what we do sometimes is we look at exceptional athletes who are tight end size doing wide receiver things, and we think that's a great tight end. Sometimes we get that wrong. Is Kenyon Sadiq a big slot?
Kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Kind of. The but I'd go a step further, and it kind of comes to the same point. When you're a tight end, you, it's in the name, right? You line up tight to the line. What that generally means is there's a guy right over you and you're in tight space. You need to be very technical with your hands to get open.
Yep.
Whereas you watch the great wide receiver, even when they're pressed at the line, you can go either way. You can juke in and out. You don't really need to use your hands to beat press as a wide receiver. Some of them do if it's a really good corner, but generally, if you're an elite wide receiver, they don't press you that much because they're terrified of getting burned. Whereas tight end, because the guy lining up to you knows right behind is a linebacker, you can't really burn them deep. They will press you. And if you've not got the hands quality to break it, it's almost like a bit of line play in terms of the D lineman, but it's reversed. The D lineman's trying to beat the tackle, tight end's trying to beat the linebacker or the safety or whoever's lined up against them, tight at the line using his hands. And I think the college rules, meaning you can line up slightly differently, and when you're an elite prospect, you probably get moved around a lot more. Like Kenyon Sadiq did, he probably didn't play as tight as often. You can make plays without ever having to do that.
Yeah, I would say so.
But
so
he's still the number one in this class because the potential upside is still there. But I just I want at least one elite trait from a tight end going this high, and I just don't see it.
So I can see that he is a functionally adequate athlete to be someone who could be a good blocker. I don't think he is one of life's blockers. he plays the tight end position like wide receiver. He plays it in the same way that a player like Tet McMillan plays wide receiver. It's a lot of body control, hand positioning. It's about using your frame to get to the ball and pluck it out of the air around other people. And that is absolutely a way to be consistently successful at the next level. But in line, there's not enough value to him in the run game for me to consider him to be someone you would put in line or use slightly off the line as a piece in the run game. So Brock Bowers, right, is not the biggest tight end on earth, but he is a functionally skilled, high effort run blocker. Okay. He's not Jake Ferguson. He's not like Adam Trautman. He's not going to throw a linebacker, but he'll wall a guy off for just long enough. Yeah. And that's where we need players like Kenyon Sadiq to be for me to grade them in the top 15. Because otherwise, what you end up with is you can end up with a situation like Sam Laporta, who is an excellent receiver, but is at best net neutral in the run game, if not a poor blocker in the run game, which has led to some inconsistencies in his output where the Lions have run the ball more and he's had fewer pure passing situation targets where his stats have flip-flopped from his rookie year to his second season. And it's like a receiving tight end is great, but if they're just a receiving tight end, they don't give you the advantage of being formationally diverse. If you think about what people like Mark Andrews, George, especially George Kittle, the advantage that George Kittle gives you is that they might be running. They might be running behind George Kittle because he is a plus blocker. He is probably one of the top 10 blocking tight ends in the NFL, let alone what he is as a receiver. So when you have someone who has such a narrow and clearly defined skill set, regardless of how desirable the athlete is, you know, you have to consider, is that athleticism just them being a great receiver athlete, or is that them being a great tight end athlete? And there's some really good tight end athletes on day three that are just like either don't have the production or lack the opportunity to express themselves. Now, I think Sadiq in the right offense would be great. Like, for example, let's just imagine that Kansas City is sat there at 29 with their second first round pick, and he's just sat there. Are you telling me that they're not going to pull the trigger? Because you would do with Kenyon Sadiq what you do with Travis Kelce. Well, what you would have done with Travis Kelce 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So and the athlete is exceptional.
Do you think Kenyon Sadiq has the off the cuff stuff Kelce does, though? Because
Kelce has very, very special spatial awareness.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. Because how often is it Mahomes is doing his scramble drill and Kelce somehow just ends up in space? And you're like, what is happening here? It's like you're saying, it's like an innate understanding. It's like Tom Brady in the pocket. He's so unathletic, but he moved in the pocket because he just understood where pressure was coming from. And understood the space he had. Kelce just has that. He has innate understanding of how to find space. And I think
I'm willing to bet that Travis Kelce has the kind of peripheral vision that quarterbacks have.
Yeah.
And that spatial understanding because of that. It's not just when Mahomes breaks the pocket either. It's just when he does the basics as well. There's like, he just understands that I need to settle here, but he will settle in a specific spot turn and face Mahomes. He'll run like a stick, which is like, 5 yards and stop if it's zone, or 5 yards and then take and run to the sideline if it's man. And when it's a zone tell, he will sit and settle down, but he will angle his body in a way that there is absolutely no way that the ball can go anywhere but his chest. And the defender is walled off because he understands where that defender is going to be by their alignment. And you can just sit, literally feel where they are and know that if he shuffles 6 inches this way, it throws that little bit easier for his quarterback. So it's like when you talk about chemistry and innate understanding, especially awareness, that's the details and nuance of what makes Travis Kelce exceptional. And I think we don't see that with Sadiq, but you've got this athlete that you could deploy in a way that I think someone like an Andy Reid could do wonders with. I don't think he should go to Baltimore because I don't see that he gives you anything that Isaiah likely wouldn't.
My only issue with the Andy Reid one, or the Chiefs one in general, is that's what I thought about Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
Yeah, that didn't work, did it?
No.
I generally thought that he'd be like a Swiss Army knife in that offense. It just did not work at all.
Yeah. So, it's like, but it's right to draft him in the first round because the athlete's exceptional. He broke all kinds of combine records for tight ends. I think
that's just going to happen more and more now, though. I think more and more guys should be playing wide receiver are going to be playing tight end because they're 6'6" or 6'5" or whatever. It's just that it's just the way the position's going.
Yeah, but ultimately, is he just a big wide receiver? Is he a big slot player? It's like, because I don't see it. Yeah. And that's like, and that kind of is the same problem I have with my tight end too, as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
On that note, your tight end too?
It's Eli Stowers of Vandy.
Ooh.
Yeah, I had Stowers. So 6'4", 235, 235 pounds. So he's got 2 years of good production. I like the player. I like the athlete, And it was weird because some of the records that Sadiq broke, Stowers then broke them. And vice versa. It's like they would break records and then the other would break it back like 10 minutes later. So they're clearly both high tier, the high level, as pure athletes. They're very much in like that 90th percentile of tight end athlete in the last 20 years.
Stowers
is slightly less.
He followed Diego Pavia to Vandy.
Yeah.
They were at New Mexico State together, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. But, and so it's like you can see the athlete and you can understand a second round grade, and I absolutely can for all the world. And it's like you get with him what you get with, and I previously mentioned, it's a Sam Laporta kind of feel to him. He's a player who's on the slimmer end of the tight end build. But he is a natural catcher of the ball. He is able to separate box players out in contested situations. He's a pretty skilled receiver. He's pretty good at separating man versus man coverage as well, but as a blocker, it's very much, again, it's okay. He's probably a slightly better blocker than Sadiq. But you still ask yourself, is he really somebody you're going to run behind at the point of attack? Is he somebody who's going to give you that much more in the run game that means that you just keep him on for all three downs and the defense isn't going to know what's going on? And again, is he a player that you kind of have to play slightly off the line or in the slot to really give him the opportunities he needs? Is he somebody who needs to be throwing screens to generate production, that kind of thing? There's nothing wrong with that. It's just in both phases of the game, is he himself a formational tell that tells you what your offense is going to do? Mm-hmm. I think, yes, he is. Because, if you're in 11 personnel and he's the only tight end, the chances that you're running the ball are not massively high. You know, and
What
if you are,
works for them
you're
is a lot
not
more
doing.
teams are playing two tight end sets now.
Yeah, but that's
It's
why, because you
yeah.
want to have that what we call a wide tight end, who's basically the big slot able to do what they do, but you still want to have that multiplicity of having that second, that six, almost six offensive linemen to create space in the run game.
Yeah.
So, and that's why we kind of do it, and that's great, especially if you have a tight end who is going to be better and more productive than any slot that you put out there. So there is a place for players like Eli Stiles. It's just, I think you have to hit on the receiving ability quite emphatically if you're not going to be a neutral or a plus in the run game. And it's very hard to do that to a quality where you can really justify it.
Well, he's two big weaknesses for me. I don't think he was. He's not crisp as a runner. He can run every route. He kind
No.
of drifts almost around. Like if he's cutting, it's like
Yep.
a boat turning rather than a sharp turn.
Is quite rounded and a quite yeah, it's not sudden, it's quite rounded.
Which I think ends up at the next level, that half second longer is a big difference. It's also easier to read where you're going when you're not sharp in the turn. And I don't think he's great. His hands aren't great, which is why I think comes back to your conversation before. I think it's why he's better out wide as a wide tight end. But he's got good quickness. He's also a hands catcher, which is rare. Tight ends often, they're not actually the best at hands, which is why they get moved to tight end from receiver when they were younger. They usually need, and when I say hands, usually being a hands catcher is a bad thing because you want to catch for your chest. But I mean, like, he can catch wide. He can make, like, if his frame's 6 feet wide, he can catch 3 feet either side of it. It's like he can catch outside his body, which often the hands of tight ends aren't as good. Which is why I do like him. It's one of his strengths. Like I said, I like tight ends with a bit of special power, and that can be his. He can make catches that most tight ends can't. But yeah, the route running kind of concerns me. But like I said, I'm not high on many of the tight ends in this class. It's not a great class, I don't think. I actually have them tight end three, but
Sure too.
it's let me get my list up because I moved two, three, and four quite a lot. Yeah, Oscar Delp, Georgia.
Now this is a conversation. This is a
Oh.
conversation. And this is a very important conversation to have, actually.
Okay. Just as in why I have them higher, or because you don't like, or
No,
what?
it's an interesting conversation because and here's my Oscar Delp take. Yeah.
Yep.
I truly believe if Oscar Delp had been more involved in that offense, he'd be a first round player. The flashes you get with Oscar Delp as a receiver are tantalizing.
It's back to our old conversation, though. It's I like Flash. I think it comes down to, and it's like the old scouts versus coaches. I obviously scout more like a coach. Coaches often say, "Show me a guy's best five plays, because I'll make sure to get I get that out of him." And
It's in there somewhere, yeah.
scouts are like, "What is he at his best? What is he at his worst? Let's see the average." That's what I got. So it's like a different way of looking at it. I've always looked at it more like a coach, I think. I just think he's pure speed. Like, his 40 time wasn't insane, but he almost looked faster with pads on. He's one of those guys. Any linebacker matched up with him, he's gone. He's rinsing them. He's good leverage. He gets proper bend and lift technique at the block, which is good.
He is a really he's like, not just for his size, he is a good blocker, which is like, there's the floor, kids. He's a really good blocker who has flashes as a receiver.
What it means is, it means you don't need to take him off.
And
it doesn't
give away the play, like you said, with Stowers. You're not giving away the play because it can block, so you don't know what they're doing when you put them out there. His problem is that his big weakness, though, is what I said Stowers' strength is. He's got short arms, which means his kind of frame for a throw, for catching, isn't anywhere near as big, and he's much more of a chest catcher. He's not making as many catches away from his body. But when he catches it, he's far more dangerous than anyone else in this class, I think. Because he's elusive as well. Because there's two different things. There's the speed, but there's elusiveness. Like, I always say it with Mahomes. How many times do you watch Mahomes and think he's sacked and then he escapes? And I don't just mean like the edge rusher's almost got him. He's wrapped up and then he's out. That's elusiveness. It's not necessarily speed. He's got both. He's got the elusiveness and the speed, which means if he can then get away, he's down the field. And I just think that his high end is higher than anyone else in this conversation for this kind of second pick of the tight ends. Again, not got him in a top 50 player, not got him in the first round, but I've definitely got him as the second tight end for me. But it's interesting. We're talking about being short. He's 6'5", 245. Which is shorter from a tight end, but it's just mental. I just like highlighting how mental these people are, that that's considered a short.
So here's the interesting thing with him. So the interesting thing with him is that he is about 4 or 5 pounds heavier than Eli Stowers, but nearly 3 inches taller. But from a functional strength standpoint as a blocker, he is light years ahead. It's like, so he played 75% of his snaps in line attached to the formation as a proper traditional tight end. Okay. You don't do that in an offense if you are not a functionally strong run blocker. And so for me, there's so much here that just says to me that plus the flashes as a wide receiver and just the floor of the player and the athlete that you can just see is in there. Yeah. It's just, I think it's just very, very tantalizing to think that it's like, think of it this way. If you are a team who has got multiple day two picks, yeah, and let's say you need a tight end and you get to like pick 55 to 75. And you pick Eli, Oscar Delp, right? I don't have a problem with it. Because it's a dart throw, but this is a dart throw where it's like, I don't have to squint that hard.
At worst, he can come in on like short yardage and be a blocker. Like, you will get use out of him no matter what, which is rare. Tight ends early. I also think he's a big part of the Georgia run defense 2 years ago was atrocious. But he's a big part of why it went from like 90th, which for Georgia is unheard of. It should not be that low. But I think they went up to like the 22nd best run attack or something in the country. Which again is where minimum Georgia should be, but a year on year improvement is incredible that much. I think he was a big part of that. But yeah, I think the mix between the flash as a receiver and the capabilities of block on the run game, I'd just have him over anybody else, not named Kenyon Sadiq.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and the passes he is catching, it's not like he's getting 5 catches for 35 yards. It's like 2 catches for 33. It's like 3 catches for 60. It's big play.
You're playing me.
Exactly. And you think about that and the value that that has, and it's like, you know, finishing the season 30.1 yards per catch. And it's not because he had 160 yarder. It's because he was consistently being targeted 15 to 20 yards down the field. And it's like, I get this. This is a dart throw, and this is not that hard a dart throw to make.
Yep. So, where did you have him?
I had about three.
Three, right. So we should have done this a lot.
Only because of the production. Yeah, the actual quality of the prospects, I think he's a more surefire, higher floor, less likely to miss prospect than one and two.
So, four, because we've kind of had the same three so far. Four, there's a big drop off, to be fair, for me.
It does, and you get into guys who you have to squint at a bit, or guys who are specific role players.
So I've got three guys close to each other next.
Yep.
It's Eli Raridan, Justin Jolly, and Max Clair.
Interesting. Yeah,
I
had Max Clair.
Max Clair's fourth. So that was kind of reverse order. It was Clair, Jolly, Raridan. In that order.
So it's interesting because both Ohio State tight ends are in and of themselves both interesting. It's weird. It's very hard though to evaluate either of them because in the passing game, because if you think about it, if you drop back and your first reads Jeremiah Smith and your second reads Carnell Tate, do you ever really get to read number three? Not really. Not really. Not that often. And it's kind of you just end up sort of, and that's why you don't see a lot of production. So
especially when he's a first year starter that's got a bit of athleticism about him. The second read's not on, he's usually taking off as well.
Exactly. And it's like,
it's not just as the first two open, it's as the first two open and then I think the third option's better than me just running.
Yeah. He's another one that's kind of in that sort of Max Laporta kind of Evan Engram Y tight end, but there's evidence that he has got better as a blocker. I would say that by the end of the season, he was like a neutral blocker. So that's at least something. And he's loose. He's a loose athlete. He's like loose and he's smooth. And the frame looks like it could probably have another 15 pounds on it. So that's good as well. He's a bit faster than you think. Change of speed and tempo. Separation and getting separation down the field. He is capable of separating, just not as acutely as Carnell Tate or Jeremiah Smith. That's kind of like, and he's a pretty efficient run after catch player. It's just there's not the volume. There's not like, you know, if I'd seen him have 70 catches for 750 yards and five touchdowns and I'd seen it, I would be like, yeah, this guy's probably a first rounder. But again, you have to squint a bit and think, is this really it? And it's like, he's not quite the blocker that Delp is. He's not quite the athlete Delp is. Not quite as physically strong as Delp is. And just sometimes he just lets the ball get into his chest more than you want. And, you know, he carries the ball loosely, but, you know, that's stuff you can just teach and stuff you can just train out of people. So he's interesting, like late day two, early day three. You might even find that some team helmet scouts sees it and goes, actually, you know what? Pick 45, pick 50. Let's do it. Let's pull the trigger. I would not be surprised at all.
Nope, sounds good. But yeah, again, I think at this point, it is just dart throws. And it's dart throws based on your kind of own opinion. Not there's all opinions, but kind of your own philosophy almost. And I think that's why the Ohio State guys might do quite well, because it's like you're saying, when you squint, what you do is you can squint and go, there's a clear reason why they weren't overly productive. Like, of course they weren't productive. Would anyone be productive? You could put prime freaking You could put Primer Travis Kelce in there and he wouldn't be overly productive. There are only so many passes to go around.
Exactly.
So I think you can easily talk yourself into these guys, and that's probably what I did there. But
Yeah.
I just think, again, I don't think it's a strong class overall. So I think some of these guys are going to go overdrafted. And I think if you're overdrafted someone, overdraft somebody, it could be worth the pick you're taking them at, rather than somebody that just happens to be the highest on the board based on basic skill set. But if you're taking someone in the third, say, you want a guy that might be worth a third round pick. And there's some guys that their floor might be a lot higher than another guy. But if their ceiling is not
Yeah.
worth the pick you're taking them at, don't do it. Whereas if there's someone else that might burn out, but at their best could be worth it, it's worth a punt. And that's kind of how I've been viewing these.
Yeah, and with tight end, the squinting is worth it because, you know, it's the GMs that do the right squinting that actually normally land the really good tight ends. So
Yeah.
you know, there's it's fun and it's interesting. It's just it is a little bit of a crapshoot, and but I do feel that some GMs are better at those crapshoots than others.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Baltimore. You seem to be quite good at picking the right ones. I quite liked Sam Roush as well. So he's a bigger player, and he's more of a tight end too. He's 6'6". He's nearly 270 pounds, but at 270, he ran 4.7. So there's a degree of athleticism there, but he is like the player is a total throwback. It's like he is like an 80s / early 90s tight end who's just a big guy who can move people and catch the odd pass here and there. He's not the most natural receiver, but I genuinely think that he's like someone who would be a good tight end too in this league. If you think about the Adam Troutmans of this world, there's a reason that Sean Payton, one of the first things he did when he got to Denver was, can we get Adam Troutman on the phone, please? Because I need him to make my running game work. And that's the kind of player that I see Max, that I sort of see Sam Roush being. So it's like, I really like him as a tight end too. It's just like, he's got some, you know, he's not a polished receiver. I mean, he's got good route running skills. He's got basic sort of ability to catch. But it's like I wouldn't say that his hands were any better than, say, a 6 out of 10. So he'd be a functional guy who could probably catch 20, 30 pass, 40 passes a year. But he's not the kind of guy that you can target 80 times a year, 100 times a year, because you just won't get the return on your investment. But he can be on the field most of the time, and he could be a plus blocker in the run game. He's certainly one of those guys that, and I tell you what, the sort of worst case scenario, he's everybody's favorite goal line tight end because he'll just move someone. So I liked him. He's also his great great uncle was Merlin Olsen, who was a Hall of Fame defensive tackle for the Rams.
Oh.
Yeah, he's related to multiple famous sports people. He's got multiple relatives on both sides of his family at the collegiate level. He just comes from the bloodlines are just athletes marrying athletes, and what you've got at the end of it is a really good tight end too. But yeah, you know, Max Clair's an interesting player, and he plays the way you would imagine. He plays like someone who just wants to hurt people,
Yeah.
and I like it quite. I like it a lot. Do you have
That's it.
anybody else that you wanted to?
Nah, not really. I think that, like I said, it's not the deepest class.
No.
And doing two positions again, I didn't want a 3 hour podcast. So
I know.
that's really
There's
me.
no, yeah, I don't think there's any Harold Fannin Jr. Like, because last
No.
year I looked at Harold Fannin Jr. and I was just like, I know you're not supposed to look too deeply into the stats of tight ends, but there was the one stat when I looked at the film that made me watch him and watch 10 games of his. And then I saw it and thought, that will translate. And that was his ability to force missed tackles. There's no one in this class that forces missed tackles at an exceptional rate. That's the only thing I would say. So there's no one that really stands out in that regard. There's no one either in this class at a tight end that's a really good contested catch player either, which is also stands out a little bit. And you kind of need a bit of that as a tight end because almost every reception you make is contested. So, you know, but it's interesting. There's some dart throws that I think might hit. And I really, really wouldn't be surprised if Oscar Delp wasn't the best of all of them.
I hope so.
I hope so too.
Because means you get something, means I get something right. Well, I had him at number two, I guess, but still. Best dart throw, best dart throw.
Definitely.
Next week, then, we've still got O-line and linebacker left, is that it? And then wide
O-line,
receiver, obviously,
linebacker,
but.
and wide receivers, and defensive backs as well.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus, indeed.
Right, we need to be quick. So next week, linebackers and O line, and then the DBs together.
Linebackers, O-line, DBs. Yeah, and then that'll be everything. So linebackers and O-line. Yeah, that sounds fine to me.
Sounds good. How do I do O
Yeah.
line?
Ugh.
Because
Not to
technically
foreshadow it too
speaking.
much, but there's lots of tackles who should be guards. But there's also a couple of guards. And no centers. So we'll just do offensive line.
Right. Sounds good.
And where the value is, I don't think there's a class that warrants us splitting it in two.
Sounds good. On that note, we will catch you all next week. We may need to start doing a double pod, try to think of the date of the draft, but we might need to do two pods 1 week. We'll fit away in a bit. But no, sounds good. Cheers, James. Yeah,
Thank you,
cheers.
Josh. Thank you for having me.
Right. Bye.